Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Stacy Waite. Stacy Waite's first full-length collection, Butch Geography, was published by Tupelo Press in January 2013. She received an MFA in poetry and a PhD in composition from the University of Pittsburgh, and has published three collections of poems, Choke, winner of the 2004 Frank O'Hara Prize in Poetry, Love Poem to Androgyny, winner of the 2006 Main Street Rag Chapbook Competition, and The Lake Has No Saint, winner of the 2008 Snowbound Prize from Tupelo Press. Other poems have been published most recently in Pinch, The Rattling Wall, Cream City Review, and Girls with Glasses. Waite taught for years at the University of Pittsburgh, at Carlow University in Women's Studies, and in the Mad Women in the Attic. She is currently Assistant Professor of English at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where she is co-host of Prairie Schooner's podcast, Air Schooner. Hi, Stacy. How are you?
I'm doing very well. It's really good to be in Pittsburgh.
We're so happy that you're here, and of course, we're trying to keep you here. We're going to chain you down and, and make you stay, but... But while you're here, we're happy that you're going to read some poems. So you're going to start with some poems from Butch Geography, right?
I am, and I decided to start out with a poem that's set in Pittsburgh. So I thought I would start out by reading one of those. And there are actually a couple of poems in the set I'm going to read here. A lot of these poems in Butch Geography were written in Pittsburgh, or their backdrop is Pittsburgh. So it's a place close to my heart. This is called "To a Woman Who Has Never Been My Lover." Pittsburgh is as much like an envelope as it is like an island between rivers. I miss you. I haven't written much of anything but a few bad love poems and letters I send to Long Island just for show. It is Saturday and it is raining. I've been thinking of learning to speak Slovak or play guitar. I live above a drugstore now. We don't have wood floors anymore. I'm still making love to the same woman. I have finally learned that she is not a poem. The squirrels here are just as afraid, the raindrops just as much like diamonds. I am writing to tell you I have lost my favorite notebook, and the museums all look at me like they're dying. I don't think I am a woman anymore. I don't like potlucks or bars or my breasts. How are you? Does the chapel still look that way, like it will slip down the hill? Block the road. It's funny, I was just thinking about that line about I live above a drugstore now. That was, those of you who are listening in Pittsburgh and familiar with Pittsburgh, then you know, maybe you know what I'm talking about. That was when the Rite Aid used to be, you know, on Murray Avenue. And then on top of the Rite Aid, I don't even know if those apartments are still there. They were not nice, but they were where I lived. So I want to change gears a little bit. I'm going to read two poems that are kind of speaking to one another. This one's called "On the Occasion of Being Mistaken for the Delivery Boy by Two Members of the Girls' Youth Soccer League at the Marriott Hotel." I am at the door, pizza in hand, like Galileo with the globe. I can hear them giggling from behind the door, their footsteps pitter-pattering. It is probably their first time ordering the pizza alone. Tipping the driver will be a sweet new power for them. I feel the eye pressed against the proverbial peephole. "Pizza guy's here," she says, "and he is so cute." I pull my red Mama Angelina's hat over my eyes, which are far too feminine and blue and will give me away. And when the door swings open, I am at the gate of a new heaven. I am the cute delivery boy who, after he is spotted by concerned neighborhood fathers, is kept away from daughters such as these. They want me to join them, to pull up a badly upholstered chair to the table and share the pepperoni pie, radiating wet heat through its bottom like an engine. I stay for a glorious hour, tell stories about the band I never played in, tell them the guitar has just always come natural to me, I say. I am self-taught, I say. I can play anything you want to hear by ear. Shauna is the one of them I love, her calves carved out like crescent moons as she props her Adidas sneakers atop the television, which is blaring Prince's greatest hits on MTV. "Can you play guitar like him?" she asks. And I think on the question of Prince a moment, his small erotic body, long hair falling around his shoulders like a black scarf, I lie again and say, I think Prince is a sissy. I never said I played this role well. The truth is I made a bad delivery boy and felt shame fall over my body when Shauna pressed her mouth against my cheek and called me a hottie. And when she asked me where the band was playing next, I said Detroit. And when she asked me where I was headed from the hotel, I said back to work. The truth is, I played classical guitar on Sundays for my grandmother, who referred to me as her little Czechoslovakian princess. The truth is, I couldn't go back to work. The truth is, I couldn't go home again, either. So I wrote that poem actually quite some time ago, many years before the book was published. And then when the book was about to come out, or I knew it was going to come out in about a year, and I was kind of doing the revisions and thinking if there was poems that were missing, I thought, you know, I feel bad about the whole Prince is a Sissy thing, even though I was quite young at the time I'm referring to. But still, someone with a degree in rhetoric and gender studies shouldn't be saying things like anyone's a sissy. So I was
especially
like,
Prince.
Prince especially. So I thought I should write a sort of apology poem. And so here's that poem. And it involves, I mean, we're on the radio, so it should be fine, but a little bit of singing on my part. Sorry about that. It's called Prince the Androgynous. When I listen to Prince, I feel bad about calling him a sissy. When I listen to Prince, it's impossible to think of anything but Prince. He's not the kind of person you can ignore. He just wants your extra time. He just wants you to, at your age, mama, not your shoe size. And you can't say the guy doesn't have a recipe for relationship success. Prince the wise, Prince the androgynous, Prince the scarved beauty, Prince the revolution, Prince the purple rain, Prince the computer blue, Prince the homophobe, Prince the God, Prince the Jehovah's Witness, Prince the Seventh-day Adventist, Prince the little man syndrome, Prince the sage, Prince the guitar riff, Prince the boy girl, Prince the prince of pop. I tried on his moves at Wednesday night bowling alley karaoke. He would have been appalled, really, at my mullet, at my flippant attitude toward whether or not I could really sing, at how I made Little Red Corvette sound like a prepubescent country song, at my being in a bowling alley in the first place. Those were the days when people smoked in bowling alleys, the days when bowling alleys were not for families, the days when bowling alleys were full of idle men. They thought of me as one of them, cheered me on as I leaned into the mic. No prince, no royalty in sight.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Stacy Waite, reading from her book, Butch Geography. So, Stacy, I'm going to ask you to sing the rest of your poems today. That was great. I kind of love that.
I try. That's my best Prince.
That was good.
Thanks.
Oh, okay. All right. You talked about having two poems that speak to one another. You know, obviously the two Prince poems did, but I want to ask you about that in a book. How important do you think that is to have a number of poems speaking to one another in a book, or do you think it's not necessary?
Well, I don't know about whether it's necessary, but I can say that for me, it sort of feels like I've been writing the same poem my whole life. And I guess what I mean by that is each poem feels like I'm trying to revise something I thought I understood the first time, or going back to a set of ideas, or that I missed something. Like, I wrote this poem about this aspect of gender, but, you know, I missed something in that poem, and I need to pick that thing up. And so there's a partly like obsessive nature to that, which I think is the nature of being a writer, whether you're a novelist or a poet. There's a kind of, you know, things we get obsessed with, and sometimes we wear them out and get obsessed with something else, but sometimes we're obsessed, you know, for life, because there's so much to learn about identity and gender and power, and I don't know if I'll ever be done sort of doing that process. And I think for me, like, it's like a value. It's also like how I live, not just how I write, but trying to really think about that every moment is this kind of revision of the previous moment. You know, it's like this new chance to write a better poem, write a poem that understands more, or a poem that asks the right question, if that wasn't the right question. And so in that way, I guess, for me, that's what a book feels like, you know? And so when I put it together, even though the poems might not necessarily be in chronological order of when I wrote them, I understand each poem as answering the one before it, or covering some part of something that the one before it misses. And so I guess that's how I think about like putting a collection together. And so I know a poem doesn't belong in that collection if I can't figure out like what other poem or piece in the book it responds to.
You may have already started to answer this, but if you would describe that one poem that you're trying to write in a couple sentences, what would that poem be?
Wow, Jan Beatty with the really hard questions. So I guess the poem I'm trying to write is sort of this question of at gender that says to gender, and I have a series of poems in the book called Dear Gender, but that asks, like, why do you exist? You know, like, what are you here for? What do you want? You know, we all do you. We all think about you and try to be you. And like, why are you here? How did you get here? You know, like these kinds of questions.
Speaking of gender.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think I have similar questions, I guess, in the poems that aren't necessarily about gender, but about myself, you know. Mm-hmm. What are you doing here? How did you get here? Mm-hmm. Why are you here?
That's kind of a big question. Okay. I think it's going to take a lot of books.
Yeah, I know. So at least there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah. Okay. Could you read more poems?
I could, yeah. I'm going to do one more poem here from Butch Geography, because why not? It also has Pittsburgh in the title. And you probably heard, if you were listening earlier, then you heard the poem that was on the occasion of being mistaken for a man. And now I'm going to read a poem that's on the occasion of being mistaken for a woman. It's intended to make the head and mind stretch just a little bit. On the occasion of being mistaken for a woman by a therapist in the South Hills of Pittsburgh. Maybe she'll hear this. Tell me again, she says, how you liked being Hansel in the sixth grade production of Hansel and Gretel. She leans in close. You've told me how it feels to be a man. How about how it feels to be a woman? And I remember only how it felt to play the woodcutter's son, the tight grip of the suspenders on my shoulders, Lila Henning's small hands as she played the role of my sister, how she pushed Mrs. Gladys, who played the conspiring candy house witch, into the oven. I was a good Hansel. I practiced making the disappointed face for the moment we realize the birds have eaten the breadcrumb trail. It felt wrong to be a woman. Wrong when the barista at the cafe says, "Have a nice day, ladies." Wrong when my mother calls my underwear panties. Wrong when my hair is tied in pigtails. I do not speak the language of women. And the therapist is trying to unwind me. She thinks, of course, that I must know what it is like, that somewhere deep inside me lives the life of a woman, if I would only let her speak. I sit still. I sit like Hansel, locked in his cage. The witch, after all, plans on eating him. If I thought a woman were there, I would go look for her. I am the kind of man who rescues, who thinks to leave a failing trail in the forest. I am the woodcutter's son, unwanted, but finally, after a close call with death, held closely and welcomed home. So I'm going to read a poem from my chapbook called The Lake Has No Saint as a way of sort of transitioning to some new work. I recently, in the last couple of years, my partner and I have a son. He's going to be 2 in February. And I've been thinking more than ever, I guess, about masculinity and boyness, and because I'm, you know, I've been given this tremendous gift and responsibility of trying to figure out what are the things you say to little kids about their identities and their names. And I even remember this moment, you know, when you have to pick a person's name, that it just, the whole thing felt so wrong to me at the same time as I realized that an infant cannot give themselves a name. But it's just a fascinating thing to sort of become responsible for someone else. So I've been thinking a lot about that and thinking a lot about masculinity and boys. And so I'm going to read a poem that I wrote, you know, before he was born and then a couple since. This is called When Learning to Be a Boy. The neighbor boys look for frogs in the yard. I do not want them to find one. I want them to invent the game in which they are not looking for something to harm. I want them to invent the game in which they are not building villages they will bomb from their plastic planes. They make the bomb noises in unison. They fall down giggling in the grass until their mother names what has been cooking inside. So I, as I said, I've been thinking a lot about, well, if you're going to raise a little boy or a young man, then how do you do that? I mean, assuming he says that's what he wants me to do. I don't know. Who knows what he wants me to do? So anyhow, and then I've been thinking a lot about my own gender in relation to his gender and that sort of thing. That's been kind of a journey. And so I'm going to read a few poems that I think are taking up this question of masculinity. So when I said earlier that there's like these corners that I feel like I haven't explored yet, or enough, this would be one of them. This poem is called When They Ask You If I'm Your Father, and it has an epigraph from a book by Larry Levis called Winter Stars, and the epigraph goes like this. Say father then to no one, or say my father was himself a house, or say each word's a house, some lit and some abandoned. When they ask you if I am your father, tell them the day you were born, your heart was beating through the Doppler like 100 moth wings tapping against a porch light. When they ask you if I am your father, say the slip knot that holds us together is made of vines. Say my body is a labyrinth. Say our hearts are two falling moons inside the twin caverns of our chests. Say your breath is the content of my lungs. Say your DNA is not a strand of mine, but your ideas, strands of mine, your fragile manhood, a strand of mine, your curveball, your sentences, your fear, your spelling errors, all strands of mine. When they ask you if I am your father, say, I am your father, in the dark voice of Darth Vader, or say, I will be your father figure, put your tiny hand in mine, like you're the sassy, irreverent George Michael of the 80s. When they ask you if I am your father, say you grew up in a town with tornado sirens. Say your mother is a sucker for men who are women, who are also men. When they ask you if I am your father, tell them how I taught you to be a man by teaching you how not to be a man. When they ask you if I am your father, say in the unshakable calm of your voice, if this is what you mean, then yeah, she's my father. And so another new poem, and this one's sort of thinking about a similar subject in the end, which is this question of what does it mean to be a man? And to understand this poem, you have to have seen the movie Good Will Hunting. So I hope, otherwise a few references might escape you. There's this great scene in Good Will Hunting where, if you haven't seen the movie, where Matt Damon is like, his character is like, having these guys are making fun of him in a bar and things like that, but he gets this really beautiful woman's number, and then the last minute he knocks on the window and sort of holds her number up, and he says something that you'll hear in the poem. So when you hear me sort of do a quote from Good Will Hunting, that's the quote, that's what he says. This is called Notes on Matt Damon. On ratemyprofessors.com, quite a few of my students suggest that my class is hard and that I look like Matt Damon. Some students have even granted me the infamous hot chili pepper rating for looking like him. It's hard to know how to interpret this. After all, Matt Damon is indeed handsome, and if my last words could be any words, those words just might be, "Do you like apples? Well, I got a number. How do you like them apples?" to the middle school bullies. Even though I'm not from Boston, the power of the accent does speak to me, but I wonder what more Matt and I might have in common other than our East Coast upbringing. After all, he was born on October 8th, a Libra, and I am a solid on top of things Capricorn. My parents divorced when I was 7, and young Matt was a whopping 13 when his parents untied the knot. I wonder, did he run into the woods in celebration? Did he dream of the day he'd actually stop seeing his father's leather shoes at the back door? Did he refuse to speak in school? Did he dress up in girls' clothes or pretend he was the lead singer of girl bands like Heart or Wilson Phillips or, even better, the Bangles? Did he want to work with his hands but find his hands inadequate? Did he want to be taller? Did he wander the halls of his middle school with notebooks full of love notes never slipped into the lockers of girls who thought of him as harmless or never thought of him at all? Did he ever eat an entire gallon of Breyer's cookies and cream on prom night while the rest of the neighborhood danced in their beautiful genders? Did he major in English like we all do because he believes language precedes action? Did he ever listen to his mother crying through the walls of his Cambridge home? Did he like Latin when he learned Latin? Or did he know when he was taking Latin that only kids that eventually go to Harvard, which he did, take Latin? Did he drop out of Harvard because he wanted to be a movie star, or because the ivy walls seemed sinister, or because he would have preferred to be the genius janitor, solving equations overnight, the unsung hero, the silent show-off, the handsome but underrated underdog? Did he love expensive gin? Is that why he married a bartender? Did he become a Red Sox fan the same way I became a Yankees fan because some inheritances we cannot turn down? Because our grandfather's opinions about Major League Baseball were more important than their opinions on racism, sexism, and war combined? Did he ever want to be a soldier? Did he know he'd grow up to gather white boy directors on HBO and combo mansplain and whitesplain racism to Effie Brown? Did he know what power and money and whiteness would make of him? Did he know what teeth masculinity sprouts in the mouth, what privilege he could not feel in the frightening woods of childhood? Did I know? Did I know the pain and danger of my failed girl skin was also the implicated privileged safety of my white skin? Did I know the tangled web we weave, Matt Damon, with our white boy smiles and perceived objectivity, with our hot chili peppers and East Coast accents? I don't want to be you, Matt Damon. What can I do to stop being you, to be some other man? The kind who sees himself clearly, the kind who offers questions and not answers, the kind of men I hope my students will be, the kind of man I hope my son will be, the kind of man who in the end knows when to sit down, shut up, and call it a night.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Stacey Waite, reading her poetry. Oh, it's great to think about that movie, too. I mean, I love that movie.
Good Will Hunting?
Yeah.
It was a movie I definitely overwatched.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I watched it again and again.
And I was really disappointed when Matt Damon was being a jerk this year.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate.
Well, I mean, everyone has their bad moments. But I want to ask you, you know, one thing that just keeps hitting me over and over whenever I listen to your poems, and I'm so happy to listen to your poems, is the sense of a solid, authentic voice that feels, as a listener, feels based in heart and soul. And yes, it's poetry, there's craft everywhere, but what keeps hitting me is a sense of the authentic and then the necessary. And I know from what we talked about earlier, you know, the poem you're trying to write over and over again, you know, how true and how important this is to you as a poet. But I wonder if you could talk about, and there's many poets who don't deal with heart and soul and the authentic. And can you talk about you as a writer driven by that? If you are.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I can say about that is I was always confused when I first got to graduate school to study poetry. I remember there being this sort of, don't say the writer, say the speaker, you know, which I understood on the one sort of literal level of like that not all poets are the speakers of their poems, that they might be speaking as someone else. But even in the moments where I might be speaking as someone else or like I'm still speaking as me in this strange way. So it was always this strange, I didn't feel like I had a choice but to speak as me. Like, and I think that a lot of times poets who find themselves particularly in marginalized identity categories or particularly women poets, poets of color, queer poets, you know, it's sort of this position of privilege to be like, it's the speaker, you know? And it's like, well, it's not the speaker. I mean, I wrote the poems. It's me. And I think that, I guess what you're describing in my poems, at least as far as I can guess, is that I never really learned to speak as anyone else, and at some point I became uninterested in doing so. I mean, I did exercises, and I guess I still do, and things where imaginative, helping myself work with images in the way poets usually want to and need to do. But really, that's all practice to come back to speaking better as myself or speaking in more layered ways as myself. And so I guess in that sense, like, you know, when people say like, oh, did all the poems, all those poems in your book, all those things happen? And I'm like, well, not all the things happen, but every poem in the book is true. And in that sense, like true to my own experience or my own voice. And so I'm glad when that comes through, and I hope that comes through. And I think if I ever felt like I didn't want to do that anymore, I would just stop writing.
Well, yeah. Yeah. But I mean, in the poetry classroom, as you know, I mean, I think part of I get your point about privilege, but as you know, part of naming the speaker as the I in the poem can also be protection for a marginalized writer who is afraid to write something down, especially at the beginning. So how do you gel that with what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right, and I think you know, I'm always talking with my students in complicated ways about how we as a workshop group kind of deal with this. And I guess I was speaking from it in that sense as more of like what it felt like to be a 23-year-old student,
right,
and to sort of stumble on this like rule in a workshop,
yeah,
that to me was like so strange, you know.
Okay.
And so I don't necessarily think like, oh, we should totally abandon that plan, but I do think that we should, you know, as I was saying before about like revision, like we should constantly keep these things up for revision, up for discussion, these things that we do in workshops, you know, I mean, experimenting, and, you know, that poets shouldn't talk while everyone, you know, and I like to kind of shake things up and kind of do things differently, but yeah, absolutely, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, okay. Could you read more poems?
I could. So, I didn't write this poem in Pittsburgh, but it's a very much a Pittsburgh poem, because, well, everything in it was in Pittsburgh, but... also because, you know, it's one thing I miss in Lincoln I live in Lincoln, Nebraska now, from living in Pittsburgh. There's so many butch women in Pittsburgh. They're all over the place. They're amazing. They're just like, you know, they're everywhere. I love them. And it's funny because there are butch women in Lincoln, don't get me wrong, but some of them don't know they are, which is kind of an interesting phenomenon. That was also the case when I lived in rural Pennsylvania, where you'd be like, hey, that's a butch. And if you said that to the person, they'd be like, no. Anyway, so as I've been thinking about this culture of masculinity, I've also been thinking about culture of masculinity between women. And so this poem kind of reflects on that, and it's called When Butches Shoot Pool. Sometimes one of them goes overboard. Sometimes one of them gets drunk. Sometimes one of them starts a fight with a woman who looks like Tony Danza. Sometimes one of them sinks the cue ball. Sometimes one of them gives the other the last cigarette. Sometimes one of them becomes the other's father. Sometimes one of them holds the pool stick like a rifle. Sometimes one of them makes fun of the other's side spin. Sometimes one of them hits a three-cushion bank shot, exhales quietly and grins like a pool shark. Sometimes one of them has the blue of the chalk on their fingertips or the blue of the blue chalk in their blue eyes. Sometimes one of them calls the other a sissy boy. Sometimes one of them plays a sexist song on the jukebox and calls their partner the wife. Sometimes one of them slaps the quarters down on the table like it's the very last pulsing left in their beating hearts. Sometimes one of them imagines their rage contained by the triangle, watches it crack open in the other's clean break. Sometimes one of them calls the shot by nodding their head in the direction of the intended pocket. Sometimes one of them is wearing the same cologne they wore in high school. But when the night is over, when they've left the bar without yelling or fighting, when they've left the last bills for the bartender, when they've both spit on the city sidewalk, when they've reached the fast food parking lot down by the river, one of them would hold the other if they cried. Not that they cry, just if they did.
The poetry of Stacy Waite. Thank you so much. That was amazing.
Thanks, Jen. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 WESA.